Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Whoever is elected president next year will face enormous, unpredictable foreign policy questions. For example, whether to pull troops out of Afghanistan, whether to repeal tariffs on China or keep them in protest of Chinese human rights violations, and how to achieve Middle East peace. But most candidates running for president have not gone into great detail about their philosophies toward international relations and military engagement. However, today in The Exchange, we dive into what they have said as we talk about the role of foreign policy in this primary campaign. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Joining us from D.C. is Jim Lindsay, Senior Vice President at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-author of The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership, also co-host of two podcasts on foreign policy, and author of the blog The Water's Edge. And Jim Lindsay, really nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio, Chris Galdieri, Associate Professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Chris, welcome back. Good to see you.
Always glad to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Wayne Lesperance, Vice President of Academic Affairs and Professor of Political Science at New England College. Wayne is a contributor to a forthcoming book on President Obama's foreign policy. And Wayne, great to see you. Welcome back as well.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, and Wayne, I want to start with you. How much attention do you see foreign policy receiving in this presidential primary season?
I think it's fair to say it's been precious little attention, actually, whether it's out on the campaign trail here in New Hampshire at local town hall meetings or on the stump, or even on the debate stage when we have an opportunity for more focused questions with the candidates. We've seen very little time spent on foreign policy. And even when there is some time spent on it, there's a real lack of specifics from the different candidates on the various issues. You'll get platitudes. You'll get some general statements of philosophy, perhaps. You'll get a whole heck of a lot of here's what Donald Trump's doing wrong, but very little by way of here's how I would move forward. So I think voters ought to ask for more. We deserve more. The world remains a dangerous place, and the United States, in my view, remains an indispensable power in the world. Despite the current administration's approach to foreign policy, there's an awful lot that we need to get from the various candidates in terms of their positions on what we're facing out there in the world. And I don't think we're getting nearly enough of it.
So given those challenges, Wayne, why do you think we're not hearing more?
I think part of it is because it's very issues are very complex. I think part of it is calculation that foreign policy issues aren't necessarily what voters are asking for. I think to the extent that you can tie in some of the bigger ticket items that candidates are talking about, like climate change or immigration, that's an opportunity to make foreign policy connections. But really, the kinds of things I'd like to see more of is, you know, a focus on our strategy in the Middle East, our strategy vis-a-vis Russia, China, not just in terms of trade, but China as a country that's exerting greater and greater levels of influence throughout the world, and certainly in its region militarily. So, again, my view is the world is a very dangerous place. American interests are always in question, and we should ask these candidates to speak to those issues.
What do you think, Chris? Voters don't care that much about these issues, so candidates don't talk about them.
Yeah, I think it's really tough to think of a primary contest in either party where foreign policy was at the heart of it. I think, you know, 2008, where the big distinction between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton was their vote on the Iraq War, is the one exception. But I don't think there's anything that dominates voters' minds, and certainly not the minds of Democratic primary voters this way. So to the extent that there is coverage of foreign policy, I think it's very reactive to what the administration is doing. So if the administration withdraws from Syria, there will be questions about Syria in the next debate. But absent that, I think left to their own devices, you know, candidates would rather talk about the economy or talk about, you know, Trump generally. And the press would rather ask, what do you think of Ellen DeGeneres and George W. Bush sitting together at a football game?
What do you think, Jim? Attention or not to foreign policy?
Well, I think Wayne and Chris have covered most of the major points. The candidates don't talk very much about foreign policy, generally only when they're asked. Just to give you one sort of statistic on that score, people on the Elizabeth Warren campaign have been toting up the questions asked of the senator from Massachusetts as she goes to various campaign stops and does town halls. She's been asked more than 100 questions.
Or change Atlantic Alliance.
27 of them had to do with foreign policy. So partly it's that candidates don't see a lot of payoff in talking about foreign policy. But also keep in mind, most of the candidates in this race have very little experience and very little passion about foreign policy, and that explains it as well.
Again, our number for you to join us with your comments and questions, what you're hearing about foreign policy on the campaign trail, 1-800-892-6477. What foreign policy matters do you want to hear these candidates talking more about? You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Jim, Wayne said something earlier that I've heard others say, that when the candidates do talk about foreign policy, they don't get very specific. Is there an argument, Jim, to stay broad, to stay general, because things shift so much on the ground and you only have so much control when it comes to foreign policy because, you know, other countries will do what they want to do?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think if you're looking at it from a candidate's point of view, there are a variety of pitfalls about getting into the weeds of foreign policy. One, as you have mentioned, is that the world could look very different on January 20th, 2021. I know we began at the top of the show talking about some of the challenges the president will face on Inauguration Day, but those challenges could look quite different. The Middle East could look very different. The issue of the trade war with China could look very different. So it's, you're really sort of moving with a much more fluid set of issues on foreign policy than on domestic policy. By the same token, again, the public is not terribly interested in these issues. You look at all kinds of polling, what it shows is the public is interested first and foremost in what you're going to do as a president in terms of things that directly affect their lives. Think about healthcare, think about jobs. And they're much less concerned about what your policy is going to be toward infectious diseases in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that sort of encourages candidates to sort of go broad brush rather than to details. We also should point out that these formal debates that we've had now four rounds of them, are pretty crowded debate stages. And when you have 10 people, or in the last debate, 12 people on the stage, it's very hard to have any kind of in-depth, granular discussion of foreign policy, regardless of how important the issue is to the country or how much it will dominate a president's agenda.
Here's an email that we got from Robin on this issue about what candidates are and are not saying. Robin says, our presidential candidates seem to have total aversion to foreign policy. And when foreign policy is addressed at all, it tends to focus only on recent current flashpoints such as Palestine, Brexit, or Kurdistan. Robin says, but far more important long term is the emergence of China with its determined strategy to dominate East Asia and world politics. Hong Kong's struggle is valiant, but it's essentially lost, he says. Taiwan will end up also under attack, and we need a policy on how to respond. The Philippines and other Southeast Asia countries are vulnerable, too. And most significantly, what about all the new militarized islands in the South China Sea? Unchallenged, Robin says, they will end up foreclosing critical shipping lanes. When and how shall we oppose the embattlements? Our candidates are all silent on these predatory incursions. And Wayne, I'd love your thoughts on this.
Sure.
A lot of the talk about China in this presidential campaign has been about the tariffs, yes or no, some about human rights violations in China. But most of it has focused on trade. What about Robin's point? There's some real national security issues here.
Robin is 100% correct there. I think the challenge is, and I think we've alluded to this, Robin knows more about this region in that one email. He's expressed more about this region in that one email than we've probably heard from any of the candidates on the campaign trail. Robin clearly knows what he's talking about. So, you know, there's a level of depth there and complexity there that the average voter isn't aware of. I think if you were to explain to voters that, you know, the Chinese are militarizing islands and coastal installations and putting, you know, missile batteries and all sorts of other threats to international shipping along the way, you think a lot of voters would be surprised by that. I think a lot of the candidates would be surprised by that. So to the earlier point, you know, one of the challenges we have is that the voting public isn't particularly sophisticated in terms of its knowledge on these issues. It's no dig at them. There's an awful lot to keep up with. We just spent a lot of time studying this stuff. still, you look for candidates to be leaders, and you look for them to take positions that eventually evolve into something pretty specific. Maybe, you know, it starts very simply as the United States is committed to keeping shipping lanes open, to preventing anybody from militarizing or limiting the access of trade. There are ways in which you can get there that will get to some of these points, but we're not even having the conversation. And I understand, and I think the point that Jim made is right about the debate stage. At the last debate with 12 candidates, the top amount of time went to Elizabeth Warren at about 26 minutes. The least amount of time, I think, went to Tulsi Gabbard. It may have been Tom Steyer, but it was around 7 or 8 minutes. When you have 7 or 8 minutes and a 3-hour show, you're not going to talk much about anything, let alone foreign policy or the complexities of foreign policy. But we shouldn't settle for that. We should insist that we have forums or debates that are specifically about, you know, types of issues. Maybe we ought to have a national security debate. Maybe we ought to have it limited to 6 candidates and have a couple of nights of those debates. If we demand that as voters, if we demand that as citizens, I imagine somebody somewhere will respond to that. And that's kind of where we get to. So, Robin, I hear Robin's frustration. I think Robin has a very legitimate point. I don't see any relief anytime soon. But this is where we are, and I think that's why this show in particular is so important, that we are having these conversations.
Well, and really, we were saying before the show started, we could do a whole show just on China.
Sure.
Because there is this trade war going on. A lot of candidates on the Republican and Democratic side have said the tariffs are bad that the president has imposed upon Chinese goods. On the other hand, Chris, most of these candidates say we need to get tough with China. There are the human rights violations against the Uyghur Muslims. There are the protests in Hong Kong. So when it comes to, like, getting tough on China but not imposing tariffs, the candidates seem to be sort of talking around in circles on this.
Right. And I think part of that is because, you know, there's no easy answer to that. You know, you'd like China to stop committing human rights abuses. You'd like China to stop using dirty forms of energy, stop burning coal, that sort of thing, have better labor practices. How do you do that? If you're an American president, you don't have that many tools for trying to get a country of 1 billion people that makes all of your phones and is tremendously influential to change what it's doing if they think it's working for them. Back when, you know, the United States started really trading with China in earnest, a lot of folks in America said, this is great because it will make them more like us. And it might be the case that the influence is flowing in the other direction. We've seen the NBA clearly does not want its players criticizing China. If you look at blockbuster movies, a lot of them now have a subplot where they bring in Chinese actors. Just for, you know, if you remember the movie The Martian, right? They had that whole subplot with the Chinese space agency. Didn't really fit, but it meant that the movie was a lot more marketable in China. So you're dealing with a really, you know, difficult situation without a whole lot of easy options. So if I'm a candidate for president, probably the most strategic thing for me to do is say something really vague and then hope that if I become president, I'll think of something.
Like you talked about before. So we should talk a little bit more about trade, gentlemen, because going over some of the issues, you know, given that it's a primary, there's not a lot of daylight between the candidates on many of these foreign policy issues. But Jim, Lindsay, when it comes to trade, boy, there are differences. So I'd love your thoughts on what you're hearing among the candidates on trade, because, you know, President Trump, for example, has been using the traditional Democratic playbook when it comes to being tough on trade, so to speak. So go ahead, Jim.
Well, Lauren, I think there's less difference among the Democratic candidates than your question lets on, at least in terms of what they say formally. Looking over all of the candidates in terms of their statements about trade, they all seem to be saying that they will oppose trade agreements that don't protect environment and worker rights. And you see very few candidates, for example, endorsing the North American Free Trade Agreement. Beto O'Rourke of Texas would be one such person. And again, that reflects the politics of the Democratic base, Democratic primary voters, which tends to be anti-trade. It doesn't necessarily reflect the views of Democrats writ large. Indeed, if you look at a lot of public opinion poll data, it shows that Democrats on the whole are actually pretty favorable toward trade and actually understand why trade matters to the U.S. economy. But in terms of the politics, sort of the safe play, conventional play in Democratic politics, is to talk about how you're not going to be for trade agreements unless they protect the environment and worker rights. Now, within that, you have people like Senator Sanders of Vermont and Senator Warren of Massachusetts, who have longstanding careers of being critical of trade agreements. But again, people like Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, sort of sanded off a lot of the edges on their trade policy by, for example, saying he's opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this big trade deal with 12 Pacific Rim countries that would have bundled up about 40% of the world's economy and been a tremendous economic counterweight to the issue of China we were just discussing.
Okay. Well, since you mentioned Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, he certainly made a name for himself the last time around, speaking out against trade agreements. He and President Trump agreed on that. Let's hear a little bit from Senator Sanders talking about trade. This audio is from CNN in April. And here he says the federal government should demand more from companies that want federal contracts, including where they choose to invest.
We have profitable corporation after profitable corporation shutting down in America, throwing American workers out on the street, going abroad, and then they line up at the federal trough for contracts. And what I am saying is if you want a contract and you are a major corporation, you know what? Don't think you're going to get a contract if you lay off, shut down plants and lay off American workers. Don't think you're going to get a contract if you don't allow workers to organize into a union, if that's what they want to do. If you're cutting back on their health care, you have to be corporate citizens, good corporate citizens.
Again, that's Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and CNN on April. And Wayne, President Trump is obviously another candidate in these presidential primaries. We're talking about the Democratic candidates, also President Trump, also Bill Weld, and to some extent, the campaigns of Senator Sanford and Joe Walsh, Representative Joe Walsh. But for the president, trade is a central part of his foreign policy. I printed out a 10-page document yesterday titled Foreign Policy, President Donald J. Trump Achievements. And the first 6 out of 10 pages are about trade. Right. And then there's all this other stuff that we've been talking about. So why has trade been such an important part of this president's foreign policy strategy?
I think if you look back to the last election cycle, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump as candidates really tapped into the anger and frustration of a lot of American citizens. And as part of their approach, it was this message that we're being cheated, that we're being taken advantage of. And for the president, the easiest way to demonstrate that is to point to trade deals that in some way harm American business, American workers. It explains to some extent the president's success in states that had gone for Obama in the prior election. So I think, you know, the emphasis on trade is less about trade as much as it is about being able to, in his mind, fulfill promises to voters about looking out for the little guy or looking out for workers or looking out for industries that were being preyed upon by unfair deals or unfair practices in other countries. All of the rhetoric around the trade war with China is about China taking advantage of it. And Donald Trump saying, I'm the guy that finally stood up to them. I think you in the clip you played from Bernie, you know, Bernie Sanders is not known for being a foreign policy guy at all. In fact, he's been criticized for not having much of that. But with Bernie Sanders, everything foreign policy somehow comes back to his notion of what's right for the working guy, right? Working man or woman. So, you know, I think, again, it's consistent with Bernie's brand and his messaging. And foreign policy is sort of attack on there. I think it's the same with the president when it comes to trade.
Well, coming up, more on foreign policy in the presidential primary races. We will talk about Afghanistan, what the candidates are saying in terms of whether the U.S. should leave. We'll definitely talk more about Syria, and we'll talk more broadly about this push by some candidates to end what they call endless wars. All that's coming up, plus your questions and comments. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what role foreign policy is playing in this presidential primary season. We're talking about what issues have come up, what themes we're hearing from the candidates on topics ranging from Afghanistan to trade. And let's hear from you. When it comes to foreign policy, what matters do you think deserve more attention from those running for president this year? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour: Chris Galdieri with St. Anselm College, Wayne Lesperance with New England College, and Jim Lindsay. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations in D.C. And all of you, Jim, you first, please. I did want to talk about what has been happening in Syria. President Trump's decision to pull U.S. support from the Kurds who've been fighting the Syrian regime with us. How do the candidates talk about Syria, James, beyond sort of saying this is bad what President Trump did?
Well, first I should point out the U.S. alliance or U.S. support for the Kurds was to fight the Islamic State, not to fight the government in Syria. So I want to sort of put that on
sure.
the table, number one. You know, the Democrats, like most Republicans, have been extremely critical of the president's decision, critical both in terms of the substance of the decision. This was a relatively low investment by the United States that had a lot of leverage, proves a big payoff, both by defeating and containing the remnants of the Islamic State, and as we've seen, keeping peace in that region. And also, I think one of the things that happened, one of the reasons people have been very upset by it, was the impulsive nature by which the withdrawal was announced. Typically, these sort of issues are handled through long negotiations. You build a plan, you try to produce order. What we got was the president surprising not just the people on the ground, but also members of his own administration with his decision to terminate U.S. support for the Kurds. And what we've seen has been the Turkish invasion of northeastern Syria, and what is clearly ethnic cleansing. And so there's a great deal of focus on the fact that this was a bad policy decision delivered poorly.
So what do you hear about the candidates saying they would do? We talked, for example, with former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld a couple weeks ago. He went on and on, as many candidates do, saying, you know, President Trump didn't do this well, abandoning the Kurds and so forth. But it's harder for me to discern what they specifically would do, Jim, and I wonder what you're hearing.
Well, I think you're quite right that the Democratic candidates, like many Republicans, have been very long on criticism, very short on alternatives. And again, I think the Democratic candidates have opened themselves up to the criticism that the president is only sort of carrying out the logic of policies they themselves have endorsed. Again, a lot of the candidates, as you mentioned, Lauren, have spoken about ending the forever wars, wanting to get the United States out of the Middle East. And this is particularly also getting U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. Most of the candidates are on record saying they would do so and do so within their first term. But there you would face the same problem. It's very likely if the United States were to withdraw troops from Afghanistan, that what you would end up with is a chaotic situation, the likely fall of the government in Afghanistan and the return of the Taliban. So, again, it's not unusual in politics to be long on criticism, short on solutions, but that's where we are today.
Well, and since we're talking about this, I would like to play a little bit from our interview with Governor Bill Weld on The Exchange earlier this month. Here he is responding to that sudden shift in U.S. policy in Syria and describing the bar that he would set for military intervention as president.
I do not believe in sending boots on the ground into another country just because we see something there we don't like. You could almost argue that that was the situation in Iraq in 2003. On the other hand, the betrayal of the Kurds, who have been a strong ally, leaving them to be overrun in a day by the Turks, who really hate the Kurds, they regard them as secessionists, is just too strong a medicine. That's not non-interventionism, that's betrayal.
Again, that's former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, a Republican presidential primary candidate on The Exchange earlier this month. Wayne Lesperance, I'd love your thoughts both on the candidates' response to what's been happening in Syria and the Kurds, but also how that plays into the narrative that these candidates have been giving on Afghanistan, because both
sure.
involve sort of U.S. involvement.
I guess I'd start with, Laura, I would start with the point Bill Weld makes. Betrayal is a very strong word. I happen to agree with it. I think you can go further and say the United States has been complicit in what's happened to the Kurds because of its withdrawal, because of the president's haphazard decision-making on this. The problem that Democrats have right now is that they're on record fairly universally about either immediate or within a short amount of time, getting American troops to come back home from Afghanistan, from other places. These endless wars, as Tulsi Gabbard would call them, the regime change wars, those sorts of things. So on the one hand, there is this call for the end of what many of them would call American adventurism abroad, bringing American troops home. On the other hand, when the president actually does that, however clumsily, let's say, he did it, they don't want to support that. There's a bit of a disconnect there. And what's interesting, Kamala Harris has probably done this the most, is her focus has been more on process. It's not about the decision to bring the troops home. It's about the process, the lack of consultation with Congress, the lack of working with his generals or with the national security and intelligence communities. It becomes a process question for her, and I think for others as well. So it's what I think voters look at this and it doesn't pass the sniff test for them. They sort of say, well, wait a minute, you're saying you want them all to come home and you're quibbling over how they do it. In some ways, that's very unfair because how you do it is important. But I think this has put Democrats in a bit of a tough spot vis-a-vis this particular issue.
I did want to ask you about Afghanistan and play a little bit from Elizabeth Warren, because one of the other issues, as we're all alluding to, that's come up is, will you be the president who brings our servicemen and women home from Afghanistan? A couple candidates have said, yes, absolutely, in my first term. Right. A lot of other candidates have said what you said, Wayne, yes, but there's a process, allies, consultation, security, and so forth. Here's Elizabeth Warren. This is her speaking in January. She said it is time to bring the troops home from Afghanistan. She also did go on to say after that a withdrawal should be planned and coordinated with allies. But let's hear.
We're now 17 years in Afghanistan, and we control, what is it, that the government controls less than 60% of all the land. It doesn't have the support of the people. The heroin trafficking is up. There are multiple groups that are terrorist groups throughout Afghanistan. Lots of different problems in Afghanistan. And what seems to be the answer from the foreign policy establishment? Stay forever.
This is tricky, Chris, isn't it, for candidates?
It is. As we've been saying, the world can change between now and Inauguration Day. So you don't know what you're going to be confronted with. And especially with this administration, there's every possibility that we, leave the show and discover that Donald Trump has withdrawn us all from Afghanistan. And that's happening.
I'm checking Twitter, Chris. Don't worry.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. So I think, what candidates try to do is they try to set a tone. They try to give a sense of what their governing philosophy for these sorts of things would be. But I think they also want to go out of their way to avoid making really specific policy commitments about we will get X done by such and such date, and as opposed to we would like to bring them home. But, and I think the folks who are talking about process I think there's some savvy going on there, because they're sort of hedging their bets and protecting their options in the event that they do become president and have the opportunity to do that.
Although process is subtle, it's not, doesn't make for a good tweet, doesn't make for a good bumper sticker. I think Joe Biden said, I'll bring those troops home from Afghanistan in my first year. That's a solid statement, and people can, assess that. Process is a little messier.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Biden on that sort of issue has a bit of an advantage. I mean, he's the only person in the Democratic field who can really run as sort of the old foreign policy hand, who's been around for years and knows everybody and would be able to hit the ground running in terms of relationships with leaders in other countries and alliances and that sort of thing. I think for any of the other Democrats who are running, you'd probably expect to see something of a learning curve and trying to figure out, if they get elected, how do you go about the process of actually presidenting with regards to foreign policy?
Go ahead, Wayne. Did you want to jump in there?
I was just going to say that the challenge is exactly right. Process is a responsible answer in many ways. It's a hedging the bets answer, but it's a thoughtful answer. But it does nothing to move the ball forward or to get voters. Or, nobody rallies around a process approach to something.
Well, got a couple great emails from listeners here, and I love that people are jumping in with their thoughts on what foreign policy issues they'd like to hear about. So again, I invite your thoughts. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org.
comment on Facebook, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So two listeners want to hear about nuclear arms control, nuclear proliferation. Judith says, I want to hear candidates talk about nuclear arms control. If the new START treaty expires in February 2021, the U.S. and Russia will have no remaining nuclear arms control treaties between them for the first time since the 70s. Wow, Judith, thank you. And Janet says, thank you for addressing the lack of discussion on foreign policy and the lack of knowledge among the candidates. I would like to know which of the candidates know how many countries have nuclear weapons. Jim, I'm going to throw that one to you. I have heard very little about nuclear proliferation and nuclear arms control in this campaign.
Well, that's because not a lot has been said about nuclear proliferation during the campaign, Lauren. I mean, I think the person who wrote in points to a big issue, which is the end of the arms control architecture that was created during the 1970s and 1980s is almost all gone. Just recently, the Trump administration indicated it was leaving, taking the United States out of the so-called Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF Treaty, which is the great achievement of Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev back in 1987, and got rid of a whole class of nuclear-armed missiles. And the New START is the last sort of thing standing. The challenge is this is a really complicated issue because it's not solely a matter of U.S.-Russian competition. There's also the issue of weapons held by other countries that have weapons. Think India, think Pakistan, think China, which is increasingly modernizing its forces. But it's also the issue of what do you do about countries that may be trying to acquire nuclear weapons? Obviously, the issue of how do you deal with North Korea? Donald Trump has tried his unconventional process. It hasn't yielded any results, but he can legitimately point back and say what Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton did didn't solve the problem either. We have the issue of Iran, and all the candidates, Democratic candidates, have said that they are in favor of going back to the Iran nuclear deal. The only problem there is if you do go back to the Iran nuclear deal in 2021, you're only about a year or two out when the first provisions of that deal begin to expire. So the real question is, what do you want to have come after that, and how do you get there? Obviously, the Iranians are going to be very reluctant to accept an extension on that agreement. Then you have the whole suite of issues dealing with technology. There is the rise of certain conventional technologies that could potentially pose threats to nuclear forces, so-called hypersonic weapons. We have the whole issue of what's called machine learning and artificial intelligence and how that may undermine stability in the nuclear area. And that's fundamentally what you want. You want to have stability so that in any particular crisis, nobody has an incentive to want to go first. These are really big issues, but they're not really being discussed on the debate trail. And I don't expect to see them discussed, in part because they're actually fairly complicated. And once you begin discussing them, I think a lot of people's eyes begin to glaze over.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those two treaties, because you're right, Jim. And Wayne, I want to turn to you. The only time we really hear about nuclear weapons, nonproliferation, is within the context of these two deals, the Iran nuclear deal and the North Korea nuclear deal. Loosely, that's what people call them. So Jim makes a great point there, and I'm really glad he reminds us that these deals have been at least a way for candidates to enter into this conversation.
And it's the only way, right? I mean, when we talk about Iran, it's when you probably see the most substance from any of the campaigns, and there's not a lot of it, the Iran deal, the JCPOA. The North Korea actually gets raised in the context of being critical of the president's approach to negotiating, not so much about nuclear weapons, but about, you know, a criticism of Donald Trump. And every once in a while, there is the hint of it at a conversation about the INF agreement, as Jim mentioned, but not really anything substantive there. These are serious issues, and what really concerns me about them is that, you know, on the one hand, it is in all of our interests that there become no new members to the nuclear club, that nuclear nonproliferation is very important for the global community, for global peace and security. And to the extent that the United States appears to be pulling away from existing arms control agreements that are designed to limit the impact of nuclear weapons, and at the same time hoping that countries don't decide to pursue it, those seem to be messages that aren't aligned. we know this is real because we've already heard recently from Turkey, the Turkish president, talking about, well, maybe Turkey needs to have nuclear weapons. Maybe that's the direction for them to go. So the threat of proliferation is always there. The United States and the nuclear halves of the world have a vested interest in limiting that proliferation. And that part of that is they have a responsibility for working on controlling the arms that they have. The fact that we don't hear nearly enough, very much at all, about these conversations among candidates ought to be very troubling to all of us. But again, as Jim said, these are very complex issues, and it requires a certain level of sophistication to be able to talk about them intelligently.
Well, I'm glad that Judith and Janet put those on the table for us this morning. Go ahead, Chris. Did you want to jump in quickly?
Yeah, I would just say to Judith and Janet, since we live in New Hampshire, you do have an opportunity to track candidates down and ask them about these questions and try to get them on the record there. And who knows, you could change some candidates' thinking on that.
Well, I want to talk about Tulsi Gabbard for a moment, the Hawaii congresswoman who really has made this end the endless wars, as she puts it. Now, she's a veteran, by the way. That's been sort of the basis of her campaign. But when she talks about this, she sometimes ties it to this nuclear safety issue. So here's a little bit from Congresswoman Gabbard speaking on The Exchange in March.
For too long, I think across both administrations, we have seen this fossilized mentality of a zero-sum game, that you're either with us or against us. That in order for the United States and for the American people to win, other people in other countries must lose. As a result of this, we're seeing, for example, how we're in a position today where we are at a greater risk of nuclear catastrophe than ever before, given the increasing tensions between the United States and other nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. There are always going to be disagreements or issues that we need to resolve with other countries, but we have to be willing to have those open lines of communication and be willing to cooperate on the areas of common interest and shared interest. That makes our country stronger, and that makes, frankly, the world better and gives us a greater opportunity for peace.
Again, that's Tulsi Gabbard speaking on The Exchange in March. And Jim, I'd love your thoughts. Tulsi Gabbard and a couple other candidates have said this, you know, repeatedly, let's end the endless wars. There's a End the Forever War pledge that at least four candidates have signed on to, a pledge put out by veterans, the veterans group Common Defense. Just basically talks about ending U.S. involvement in many of these conflicts. How have those End the Forever War candidates influenced the debate that we're hearing in these presidential primary races?
Well, I don't know that they have influenced the debate. I think they're capturing a broader sense in the American public that has soured on the benefits of called military intervention or, if you prefer, military adventurism. But I think the sort of talk about the forever wars, the regime change wars, tends to sort of obscure some important things. If you look, for example, in Syria, the United States was there with a very small footprint for the purpose of helping others defeat the Islamic State. Why? Because we judge the Islamic State, rightly in my view, to be a threat to U.S. national interests. And something on the order of 10 to 12,000 Kurds died fighting the Islamic State. The number of Americans, much smaller. Likewise, the U.S. presence in Afghanistan wasn't driven by a desire to change regimes. It was a result of the fact the United States was attacked on September 11th. So I think that they tend to obscure some of the important issues here. Then the question finally becomes one of, yes, you want to get out, but how do you do it? As Mayor Pete Buttigieg likes to say, are we going to do it poorly or are we going to do it well? And that's where the real argument is. That's where the devil's in the details.
That's the process issue that Wayne brought up. And coming up, we'll talk about candidates who say climate change is going to be a major foreign policy issue for them. Also, the foreign policy issue of foreign interference in our elections. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Texas is a key place to run for president, especially for a native son. Beto O'Rourke represented El Paso in the House. Now he's battling to stay in the Democratic primary race. His progressive agenda is finding an audience and getting strong pushback from some conservatives. Our series Foresight 2020 continues with your questions for Beto O'Rourke next time on 1A.
That's This Morning at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Indigo Blues & Company, boutique specializing in laid-back clothing and unique accessories. Main Street Contoocook and now in the Capitol Plaza in Concord. IndigoBluesAndCo.com. And from the new Lexus RX with dynamic handling and a 12.3-inch touchscreen, available in hybrid all-wheel drive, luxury crossover reinvented. Learn more at Lexus.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, what New Hampshire's bail reform debate is all about. Join us for that Wednesday on The Exchange. This hour, what the presidential primary candidates are saying about foreign policy and why, according to our guests, they're not saying more. Let's get your thoughts. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Jim Lindsay, Wayne Lesperance, Chris Galdieri, right back to our listeners. And Keith is calling from Manchester. Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening to that segment about Syria, and to a certain degree, I think there's something somewhat unfair about the treatment of the Democratic candidates. I don't know how you can expect them to kind of predict what the next crisis Donald Trump is single-handedly going to make a precipitate problem, you know, that is going to launch on people at any given time. This was not a crisis that was necessarily on anybody's immediate radar. This was a crisis of Donald Trump's, at least of Donald Trump's timing, if not of his making.
So, Keith, a little unfair to criticize Democrats for not being specific when you just don't know what's going to happen the next day. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, this isn't just what's going to happen the next day. This is what is the current president going to cause to happen in the next 2 hours.
Keith, I really appreciate the call. And Jim Lindsay, I want to turn to you first. Go ahead. What do you think?
Well, I think there's an element of truth in the point that Keith makes. And I think that the challenge you have as a candidate talking about foreign policy is that events can develop pretty quickly, Laura, that you then have to respond to and say something. I think the broader issue here, though, I think what we were talking about in the conversation about the way the Democrats talk about the issue of ending the forever wars and getting troops out is that they are open to the same kind of criticisms that they are making of President Trump, because their criticisms simply aren't process ones. It's also substance ones, betrayal of the Kurds, leading to instability, what looks to be ethnic cleansing. And on that score, someone could reasonably look at what they have said is what they hope to do in terms of lowering U.S. troop levels in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, as likely to trigger exactly the same kind of outcomes. I think that's a fair criticism to make.
Thank you very much for the call, Keith. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Last point I want to make on this idea of, you know, because there's so much more in foreign policy than just military intervention, but obviously that's really important. But there has been a lot of conversation about what's the bar for you in terms of military intervention. And Wayne Lesperance, there are two veterans in this race who have really sort of brought their experience to the table saying, hey, I've been there, and we need to be really careful about where we set the bar. I'd love your thoughts on how those two are influencing the discussions around this in these primary races. I'm talking about Pete Buttigieg and Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah. I don't know how much they're influencing it. I think it's good to hear that when it comes up. I think probably the hardest job that the president ever has is a decision to send young men and women into harm's way. We've done so many shows in the last 20 years with you, Laura, whether it was after 9/11 or Iraq or Afghanistan. And you know, as someone who comes from a family who has three members that were affected by their service, these are serious issues. So, I think it's important to listen to candidates who have had that experience. I think when you listen to Tulsi Gabbard talk about that, it's very much a part of her mindset that, you know, her opposition to the forever war is really about the guys on the ground, the men and women that are shoulder to shoulder, who pay the price for these decisions. We didn't link veteran care to veterans issues to this, but for them it is all linked. When you listen to Pete Buttigieg and Tulsi Gabbard talk about foreign policy, they talk about veterans. They talk about service personnel and the lives that they're leading in the execution of these policies. I think Buttigieg is also brought this forward, he has a bit of a different perspective. His deployment to Afghanistan, he talks quite a bit about that. So that becomes a tool for him, not just to talk about, you know, the soldiers on the ground, but also the policy. And I think he has skin in the game. And my take on it is his sense is that there's been an awful lot of energy, money, and sacrifice made on Afghanistan to sort of pull out willy-nilly. That seems like a betrayal of all of that that effort. So you hear some of that. There was a time in our history when you being a veteran was almost a prerequisite before you could run for president. That's no longer the case. So it's a refreshing return to the old days, I suppose, to have two candidates that are actually raising those issues, active duty and otherwise.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Mayor Buttigieg. This is him speaking at Indiana University on the importance, as he sees it, of military restraint.
The next president must set a high bar on the use of force, and an exceedingly high bar on doing so unilaterally. When America acts alone, it can only be because core interests are at stake and because there is no alternative. Notably, this is not currently true of the situation in Venezuela. It is not currently true of the situation around Iran. It is the difference between the necessary response to 9/11 in Afghanistan and the self-defeating invasion of Iraq. It is, in short, the difference between Normandy and Saigon.
Again, that's up in Indiana. Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking at Indiana University. We got an email from Michael who says foreign policy isn't easy. He says there's little talk because there are no good answers. Michael says, I can't point to a foreign policy win within the last 20 years that wasn't highly compromised and came in for serious critique. By the way, it's easy to say end the endless wars as long as we're comfortable with standing by while up to 500,000 people are killed and 22 million refugees are created, as was the case in Syria. So that's from Michael. Thank you, Michael, for jumping into our conversation. Here's another email that came in from Ray, which is really interesting, and I want to hear from everybody on it. Ray says, we continually hear about sanctions. Can someone explain what these sanctions are and how their effectiveness is evaluated? And Ray, thank you, because when you go through all these topics, and Jim, I'll turn to you first, you do hear these candidates saying, let's impose sanctions on Russia, let's impose sanctions on Turkey, let's impose sanctions on China. Ray's right. What are these sanctions and how effective are they?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad that Ray asked it, Laura. I mean, if you look at sanctions, they cover a whole range of things. You could have sanctions that essentially constitute the refusal to sell anything to a country. If you look at, for example, the United States sanctions on Iran, they cover pretty much everything the United States could conceivably sell to the Iranians, and actually go beyond that by threatening sanctions against others that trade with Iran. But you can also have much more narrow sanctions, oftentimes sanctions that are financial or targeted against specific individuals. So, for example, in the wake of the Turkish invasion of northeastern Syria, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on a specific set of Turkish officials. So you can run from very narrow, very targeted, to very full and complete. The way sanctions are expected to work is to inflict pain, and then that pain presumably makes decision makers in the target country change their way of behaving. Okay, so it's really two steps. And so you'll often hear, for example, the president talk about how his sanctions on Iran are inflicting great pain on the Iranians. That's true. But that's the means, it's not the end. What you're hoping is that that economic pain is going to lead a government to change its behavior. And the sort of history of sanctions suggests that more often than not, sanctions fail in that purpose.
Really?
Because when you think about it, what happens is when you have broad-based sanctions, they tend to affect the public, and usually the countries being targeted are not democracies. People don't have a say, right. And the people at the top of the regime can actually sort of shield themselves from the embargo, and indeed many cases make money off it because they can control what money comes in, what can be imported. You see this over and over again. Again, look at North Korea, where the elite lives quite well, and the vast majority of the people live in extreme poverty. So sanctions are sort of very crude tools, and that's one of the moral objections to using particularly broad-based sanctions, is that what they do is punish ordinary people who have no voice in their government.
That's interesting. And I'm guessing, Wayne, that often leaders of these countries upon whom we put sanctions say, hey, look at these bad Americans and they're hurting you. It doesn't work out from a PR standpoint.
It's the oldest playbook. Playing the playbook is to sort of point when you're in a country like Iran or North Korea, to point externally to the enemies out there that are targeting your people and say, this is why we all have to sacrifice because the bad guys are over the United States. The elites always find a way, or generally find a way, to overcome whatever limitations come from sanctions because they're the elites. They have the resources. The one area where sanctions are useful is politically. The president gets to stand up in front of a crowd and say, I impose the toughest sanctions ever on this country or that country. So there's a political value to being to sanctions in within U.S. Politics, political circles. But I agree completely with Jim. In terms of their efficacy abroad, there's limited utility there.
Well, I want to turn to two more issues that are newer in these foreign policy discussions. We've talked, you know, for a long time when we talk about foreign policy in the political context, we've talked about Iran and North Korea and Afghanistan and trade, and we should. But there's two gentlemen that seem to be emerging this time around. One is climate change, and more than one candidate, including Republican Bill Weld, said climate change would be a key part of their foreign policy strategy. Let's hear a little bit from Tom Steyer. He's the billionaire businessman, Democratic presidential candidate, and he says this is going to be at the heart of his foreign policy.
Eliminating our dependence on oil, gas, and coal will strengthen our national security, give us the moral authority to demand other countries act, and make us richer and healthier. The plan also ends all American fossil fuel investment abroad as soon as possible. I will strengthen our national security by greening the Department of Defense and make all non-combat military operations, facilities, and contracts carbon neutral by 2030. And I will work to define environmental crimes against humanity so that countries and multinational corporations are held accountable for uncontrolled pollution and deforestation that endanger millions of lives.
Again, that's an ad from businessman Tom Steyer. What do you think, Chris Galdieri, climate change as a foreign policy issue? In the past, if candidates talked about it at all, it was more about an environmental issue or an energy issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's recognizing the reality that, you know, it's one planet with one climate. So you can't address it simply by actions you take in your own community or nation. It really requires a bigger buy-in. I think that's why so many of the Democratic candidates are running on the idea of rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, for instance. It's sort of a twofer. It says you're committed to fighting climate change, and it's a rebuke of the Trump administration's decision to withdraw from that.
Yeah, when you look at the foreign policy, climate change is a foreign policy issue. That is one of the first things that these candidates say. Is there any depth to that, Jim? What do you think, beyond saying, yes, I would rejoin Paris, yes, I would invest more heavily in green energy? What do you think?
Yes, I think there's a lot of depth. I think if you look at the Democratic side of the ledger, most of the candidates recognize that climate change presents an existential threat, and that the United States needs to take action, not simply abroad by rejoining the Paris Accord, but by doing things at home. The problem, however, is that the public is not united behind the idea that climate change is a major concern that requires any significant investment or sacrifice. And that's why climate change may be an issue in the general election, but it's not obvious it will work in the Democrats' favor, given where the polls are. Yes, most Americans think that the climate is changing, but they don't put it as a number one concern. And indeed, I would expect in the campaign that President Trump would take on any Democratic candidate on climate change and argue that essentially what the Democrats are doing is going to run the American economy into the ground. And that's part of the unfortunate framing of the whole climate debate as pitting sort of climate versus jobs, when you actually could frame it in a way to talk about how investment in green energy actually can create a lot of jobs, that this is not an eat your peas and spinach moment, but actually an opportunity to think big and to really remake our economy. Yes, there will be transition costs, but it can be done. But I think a lot of the framing in the media as well as in political campaigns, has it as, well, if you want to do something in the climate, what you mean is giving up jobs. And I think that's a big mistake.
I do have to ask you all quickly, and we're going to do a whole program on this later, but Wayne, foreign interference in U.S. elections, the news stories keep dribbling out sure. that there was more and more interference by actors from abroad in our elections. Are the candidates even looking at this?
They do. You hear this on the campaign trail, but it's very superficial. It's a very strong reaction to at a minimum is election tampering. At I think more appropriately is an act of war. Trying to influence the outcome of an election in the United States is an act of war. And I think that on the Democratic side, you hear all of them, you know, in different versions of their outrage at the lack of progress that we've made in addressing it. We're going to have another election, and I think most of the candidates have said some version of there's very little that's been done to ensure that it's going to be safer or more secure election in 2020 than it was even 4 years earlier. You still have on the Republican side, you know, the president saying, well, nothing really happened there. It's because he interprets it as a questioning of the legitimacy of his election. But even, you know, Bill Weld and others who are running on the Republican side have said, no, this is serious and we ought to take this serious. Has anything actually been done? I don't think from the candidates, I don't think you hear anything very specific other than we need to do something about this.
This gets to the question we got earlier from Ray about sanctions. Some yeah. candidates have said we should sanction Russia if we find out that they're, you know, playing funny with our elections and so forth. What do you think, Wayne?
Should we sanction them?
I think, get tough on Russia rhetoric.
Well, it's not just Russia, though. We're learning that the Iranians are now working yeah. at this. We know that the Chinese
China,
have.
Right.
So, you know, I think the mentality has to be this is a new front, a new national security front that needs to be taken much more seriously than it has been. And I think we need to have very open, frank conversations. But again, back to the open of the show, we're not talking about these issues. We're not. The candidates aren't getting on the record. Nobody's pressing them. When you bring them into the studio, Laura, it ought to be one of the questions. You know, no offense, but it ought to be one of the questions. Maybe it is, but this is where we need to press these folks.
Well, point taken, and a perfect segue, Wayne, to let listeners know that our series of 2020 presidential primary candidate forums continues next week. We talked to Bill Weld earlier this month. These forums are being held in collaboration with New Hampshire PBS. On Monday, NHPR's Casey McDermott and I are going to sit down with Democrat and billionaire climate activist Tom Steyer. The interview will air live at 9, as always, replayed at 7 p.m., as always, before a live audience. You can join us. You can be here by getting your free tickets at nhpr.org/events. Once again, that's nhpr.org/events. Chris Galdieri, thank you very much for being here this morning. I really
Always
appreciate
a pleasure.
It.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Chris Galdieri, associate professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College. Jim Lindsay, thank you also for your time. You're a busy guy. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura, for having me.
That's Jim Lindsay, Senior Vice President at the Council on Foreign Relations in D.C. And Wayne, you're always helping us out. Again, much appreciated.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
That's Wayne Lesbron's Vice President of Academic Affairs and Professor of Political Science at New England College. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.